very much curtail the ability of a court or the, you know, the circumstances in which a person's going to be revoked now.
However, Representative Springer, those are not followed when the officer makes a cogent reason for not following. And that happens. We have cases, you know, it's the old thing that if there's just to give you examples, a recent study corrections did, 72% of the people who are convicted of a crime before age 17 fail on probation. Of course, 28% don't. So if you could make a cogent reason why that person should be in that 28%, that's a reason for keeping them on probation. If you can make a reason before judges why somebody should be revoked, although the behavior in general is not the kind that would revoke, but in the specific case, because of factors, because of attitude, because of intangibles in it, very often they will. And the same thing, I will say that about the parole board. The parole board will look at cases on an individual basis, regardless of the fact that you have to be convicted of a felony. You don't. I have had cases revoked with fair regularity who have not been convicted of felonies, but have violated terms of probation, because those very terms that they violated were indicative of some other behavior, coupled with the person's attitude, personality, and behavior. So it worries me that we will have these kind, that we will, you know, go to this kind of rigidity.
Well, we don't have a lot of time to get into a big discussion, but I guess I'd ask you if those terms or those values you talked about, you know, attitude, behavior, are somewhat subjective. And I guess one of the concerns is to try to eliminate subjectivity to the extent that it creates disparate results in terms of how people in similar circumstances objectively are treated by the system, notwithstanding the personalities involved.
The reason you hire professionals in a business is so that they, based on their experience and knowledge, can make some sort of evaluation when you're dealing with human behavior. Yes, it may be subjective, but I may interview somebody whose goals or means of obtaining are totally unrealistic. Based on my experience, I can tell you that of the mass of people with this kind of unrealistic expectations and attitudes, for instance, the alcoholic who tells me, I don't need an alcohol program, I'm going to make it on my own, I've made up my mind, I'll never drink again. I know, I can tell you from experience, very personal, that based on that, his chances for success are about nil. Now, that may be subjective, but it is not subjective based on speculation, emotion, on any of those things. It's based on a lot of training and a lot of experience. And I don't think that when you deal with human behavior, that we have some perfect system where we can eliminate that. And I don't think the parole and probation officers are doing it based on prejudice. And the predictions, as I indicated, the predictions of the pre-sentence writers turned out in Todd Clear's last analysis to be the most reliable predictor of future behavior. So it isn't based on disparate subjectivity. It's pretty much on, more so than all these other factors.
Thank you.
Thank you, Si. Mr. Snyder, or you want to testify? I know you've been out wrestling on dates. 2715.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Members of the subcommittee, I'm Paul Snyder, representing Association of Oregon Counties. Mr. Chair, I've already said the comments that I had to make, just simply to say that sentencing guidelines, that the paramount consideration for us is that we have them. And we'd like to be able to work out the differences between the bills.
Fine. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Anybody else who wishes to be heard on 2715? Not, we'll close that hearing on that bill and go to 2587, related driving records. Kruger, Carl Kruger.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, I'm Carl Kruger, manager of driver records section for the Motor Vehicles Division. House Bill 2587, in its current draft, requires the Motor Vehicles Division to screen additional information regarding non-motor vehicle-related offenses before we give it to the public. The requirement to screen DMV records is cumbersome and would require additional workload and around 120 hours of computer programming. If the purpose of this bill is to prevent insurance companies from using juvenile denials that are a consequence of non-motor vehicle-related offenses, then we suggest that their use be excluded within the insurance statutes. Section 2, subsection 2E, allows a police officer acting in an official capacity to access this information. Police officers, for the most part, receive our record information from the law enforcement data system, which is more commonly referred to as LEDS. Most courts, prosecuting attorneys, and some other agencies have access to LEDS records. To restrict the use of LEDS within those groups who currently have access would be difficult, if not impossible. I have seen the testimony that the Juvenile Rights Project is proposing. I believe they're going to propose an amendment. And addressing that amendment, I would say that the DMV is opposed to suppressing entries, but would have no objection to the amendment that they're proposing. One other comment that I'll make is that the bill in its current form states an emergency condition upon passage that it would go into effect. And in its current form, we would need to work with the courts, develop forms, and also the computer programming. And so I would suggest that the emergency clause be deleted if possible. That concludes my testimony.
You're probably not the right person to ask. Do you know, this came to us from the Committee on Transportation. Who are the original sponsors for this bill?
Mr. Chairman, that I don't know.
Okay. Any questions? Thank you, Mr. Kruger. Appreciate that. Steve Jacobson.
Could I ask the candidate that the Juvenile Rights Project join me as well? I think we have the same position. Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, Steve Jacobson from the Metropolitan Public Defender's Office. And to my right, Candace Singer is a certified law student with the Juvenile Rights Project. They have some written testimony that hopefully has been provided to you.
I think we have that.
I think it's in front of you there. We basically have the same position, and I'll turn it over to Candace in a minute to say what the specific amendments are. There's not only this one bill addressing this subject. You have two other bills set for a week from Thursday addressing the same subject. You've already heard in subcommittee number 3 of Judiciary another bill addressing the same subject. These things have been coming out of the woodwork because this law that got passed 2 years ago has a basic unfairness about it, and that is that it cancels the rights of some young people to drive their vehicles when the offense they commit has nothing to do with driving their vehicles. Amendments have been offered in the bill that has been heard already by the other subcommittee. That's a judge's bill, and they allowed this amendment to be made to their bill, I understand, with their consent.
Do you know the number of that bill?
That bill is number 2542. I think that would end up being a little different than this, and I'm not sure if there's any movement on the other issues in that bill. Therefore, we would ask you to consider the same spirit of amendments with regard to this bill and take care of the problem once and for all simply by amending the statute so it wouldn't do this. It wouldn't cancel people's driving rights based on non-traffic-related offenses. And I'll turn it over and be happy to answer any questions.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, first I'd like to say that we strongly support the idea in the bill which differentiates between children who have alcohol offenses that involve motor vehicles and children that are charged with offenses that don't involve motor vehicles. We don't believe that children who are charged with offenses that involve that don't involve motor vehicles should suffer the same severe penalties that the other children do. We don't believe that the bill goes far enough, though, in order to remedy the excessiveness of the punishment to the children who are charged with alcohol offenses that aren't related to motor vehicles. The amendments that we submitted substantially eliminate all the provisions that are in the bill. By replacing them with two changes in Section 5, we feel that we can achieve the same purpose. The first amendment we made was we limited the suspension or denial only to cases involving involving motor vehicles. And the second amendment we made was that we would allow the court to have discretion in deciding whether or not to apply the penalty at all. Presently, children who are charged with an MIP can lose their license for over a year. And I'm sure you've already heard their insurance rates can double. This is extremely excessive if the child hasn't been involved in a motor vehicle. In many instances, the children that are affected by this bill are those that take the responsibility and refuse to get into a car with someone who has been drinking or refuse to drive themselves after they've been drinking.
Representative Phillips has a question.
Excuse me?
Representative Phillips has a question.
You just made some gross generalizations, and I want to know if you can back them up with facts. How many of these students that are picked up on MIPs were the, quote, responsible person that went home walking instead of driving? You mentioned that you want the court to have discretion. For the last couple of sessions, we've been concerned about the discretionary decisions made by courts throughout various counties that range in great deals whenever they're provided discretions, and it would be best to give some set guidelines. How did you address those issues, and what statistics do you have to back up some of your assertions?
I don't have the exact statistics as far as how many children had denials
because of walking
and how many because they were involved in cars. But we had two clients that came to us who, after being at a teenage party, had drank some beer and chose to walk home rather than drive.
Mr. Chair.
Both of their licenses were suspended.
Representative Phillips.
Two clients at how many, in what county, and how many MIP citations are you talking about totally? I mean, is it two to a rate of 1,000, or is it two to a rate of 5,000 citations, or is it two to a rate of 10?
I don't have the exact statistics. I can sure try to get them for you.
Thank you.
In addressing your second concern about the judge's discretion, the entire juvenile system is based on individualized treatment and the court using the least restrictive alternatives. In certain circumstances, like the two that I just mentioned, if the judge had discretion, the outcome might have been more fair. I'd also like to make one more note that 809-260, as it now stands, has not discouraged minors from drinking. We do have statistics that show that the arrest rate for alcohol use among minors is still rising and has not decreased since the enactment of 809-260.
We have a problem in the sense that we're going to have to go into fourth session in a few minutes. Let me ask you something. This companion, not a companion bill, but 2542 and sub 3 that you mentioned and the other two bills coming down, is this, could your amendments or whatever point you're trying to get to on this be handled through that bill? I'm trying to decide whether to go ahead and act again on this bill or go ahead and try to focus us down on one committee and one vehicle, rather than trying to have four bills.
I don't think either of us really know the status of 2542. It was a judge's bill, and it was on a different subject, and they accepted this amendment, but I don't know if there's really going to be any action on that committee. Yeah. This is the first one of these bills to come up that really was meant to deal with this issue, so this might be the appropriate one to target.
Okay, what I guess what I ask you to do then is take a look at 2542, talk to Mr. Taylor about the status of that one, so we can either tell that one to get off track or whatever. And then if you could provide us with some detailed information about the statistics that Representative Phillips was alluding to, then I think that would be helpful for us, too.
What I've seen is that over 90% of the suspend cancellations are on non-motor vehicle-related offenses, and that's from the Department of Motor Vehicle newsletter that I occasionally get. I think Mr. Kruger could substantiate that.
Okay, then perhaps you could give us that information, and we can discuss that. But.
Also, one more small point. There are two other bills that are substantially the same as this bill that we've just prevented, and that's 2797 and I think 2932.
Those are both scheduled for March 19th in this subcommittee.
In this subcommittee. Okay. What I want to try to do is prevent us having things going through here that are going to contradict right. each other.
Those are all at the request, rather than a committee, were at the request of individual citizens who have been subject to this unfairness, and they're coming up all over the place. I don't know how many there are total.
Okay. Well, we'd appreciate some further information, and then we'll be aware of these and where they might be. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Mr. Springer. Or Phillips. Thanks. Sorry. It's been a long day.
If Chairman went along with it, I'd say thank you. Otherwise, you should know that several bills came up for pre-session filing for this committee to do just what this, and they received, to my knowledge, I don't believe, any support. So just so you know, that doesn't mean they won't get attention or looked at, but you weren't here at our December meeting when they were debated, so just so you know.
I think it came out of, was it Nancy Peterson was the chair of that subcommittee?
No, Dick was the,
okay.
It was full
yeah,
committee.
I saw the action after it happened. I wasn't there.
Okay.
Okay, thank you very much. We're going to have to take a recess. We'll have to be on the floor for a while. My hope is that we'll get back up here. I can't give you a time, but we'll make an attempt to get back up. I apologize to those of you here for hearings. I can't tell you when we'll be back. If it starts running up towards 5 o'clock, go home. But we'll try to get back within a half an hour if possible. So we'll stay in recess. Order. This is a hearing on House Bill 2512 relating to fire protection. Mr. Underwood.
Thank you. Mr. Chairman, member of the committee, thank you for the opportunity to appear today regarding House Bill 2512. For the record, I am Gary Underwood, Deputy State Fire Marshal. I am here representing the State Fire Marshal Olin L. Green. Certain Oregon statutes authorize the entry into building and premises for the purpose of conducting routine fire safety inspections and to conduct fire cause investigations. The particular statutes involved are ORS 476.070 and 476.080. These statutes make no mention of search warrants or consent as a prerequisite to such inspections. The United States Supreme Court has ruled that even though authorized by state law, such inspections are limited by the U.S. Constitution and these procedures protecting individuals from unreasonable searches and seizure. The purpose of House Bill 2512 is to provide specific guidelines for the issuance of administrative warrants for the purpose already authorized by statute. 1982, the State Fire Marshal requested advice from the State Attorney General on this issue. The Attorney General responded with opinion number 5375. In that opinion, the Attorney General stated that he believed either a search warrant or consent is required before a fire inspector may conduct a routine administrative fire inspection and suggested that specific statutory language would help to clarify procedural steps which should be taken by fire inspectors seeking warrants. The State Fire Marshal respectfully requests your approval of this bill.
Thank you, Mr. Underwood. Roger Cleland with the Oregon Fire Marshal Association from Eugene was signed up to testify, but may have left, and I just to note for the record that they were going to testify in favor of this. Is that your understanding of your position?
Yes, sir.
Thank you. In section 5, sub 2, which is on page 2 of that bill, it mentions that in executing an inspection warrant, the person authorized to execute the warrant need not inform anyone of the person's authority and purpose, but may promptly enter the designated building or premises if at the time it is unoccupied there is no one in apparent control. And I when I read that, I was wondering, well, who would there be to notify if there wasn't anybody there in charge anyway? And I'm just wondering if I didn't understand the purpose of that particular subparagraph. Do you know why it's there?
I believe that probably that is referring more to a situation where you would have a fire and the building would be unsecured, and therefore you would be able to get your warrant and approach the premises. It would not be controlling a situation where you had a building that had locked doors. We have no intention of breaking down any doors or going into any premises that is not. I'm sure that was intended to pertain to unsecured property.
Also, maybe council can help me with this one. I'm not sure if I just understand the wording here. In section 3, sub 2, cause shall be deemed to exist if reasonable legislative or administrative standards for executive. Is that in reference to specific legislative provisions for issuing warrants, or I don't know if I understand that particular paragraph at all. The meaning and the wording of that.
Excuse me, which section was that?
Well, I'm particularly looking at section 3, paragraph 2.
Okay.
Sub 2. Cause shall be deemed to exist if reasonable legislative or administrative standards for conducting inspections are satisfied. And I'm wondering what the references to legislative standards are. Are we talking about standards set up for inspection?
Yeah, I'm sure they're referring to the state law that gives you the right to go into a building to conduct at reasonable hours to conduct a routine inspection.
I'd just like to understand who makes that determination then? Who makes the determination if of reasonable legislative standards are met?
Yeah.
Maybe Councilor, help me.
Sure.
Watch this.
Sir, if you could tell me what. You conduct inspections on a random basis, or do you conduct inspections for cause, or what? How do you do it now, sir?
Our inspection procedure is set out by ORS 476.070, which basically says the State Fire Marshal, the Deputy or Assistant State Fire Marshal, or any of them may at all reasonable hours and performance of the duties imposed by the provision of ORS 476030 enter upon and examine any building or premise wherein fire has occurred and other building or premises adjoining or near the same. 476080 says that the fire marshal or his deputies at all reasonable hours may enter into all buildings and upon all premises except private residence for the purpose of inspections to ascertain if fire hazards exist therein or thereon.
One further question. So currently you inspect buildings whether or not you have reason to believe there is a fire hazard?
Yes, sir.
Okay. And you can inspect buildings for fire hazards without any type of probable cause?
Yes, sir. We do obtain permission to make that inspection, though. We do not just walk into the building and say we're going to make an inspection. I think the Attorney General's opinion says that you must have consent or a warrant to do that, and so we ask for permission to make that inspection.
Do you have a copy of that opinion with you?
Yes, sir.
Okay.
Mr. Chair?
Representative Springer?
Okay, I had a chance, I guess, to look at this issue briefly when it was down in the State and Federal Affairs Committee, to which the matter had been initially referred. And I had a few questions at that time, which I assume counsel perhaps has already raised. It looks like we're relying upon an Attorney General's opinion, which is at least 4.5 years old, and the law tends to change pretty quickly sometimes in the area of search and seizure, and I'm curious whether or not there's been any up-to-date research on this particular issue, or if the Attorney General's office was consulted in the preparation of the language that appears in this bill. Would you?
We consulted them for the language in the bill. That's what they supposedly guided us through this bill at the time it was initiated.
I guess I'm a little curious also. I think I raised this point. This opinion came down 4.5 years ago, and since then we've had the 83 session and the 85 session, and now it's the 87 session, and apparently, notwithstanding this opinion, it didn't, for one reason or another, interfere with your operations to the extent that you felt it necessary to come before the 83 or the 85 session. Does that mean you haven't had any problems, or why the lengthy gestation period here?
Within that period of time, we've had some U.S. decisions that affected this situation, and so it has gotten to the point that after several decisions were made, we have not had any large amount of problems with this particular situation. I think that the ones that we have had led to this bill so that we could clean up. It's a cleaning up kind of thing, that so that the people applying for administrative warrants and the people that are issuing them have some guidelines as to how to do that. Part of this, the APD, Accident Prevention Division, has an administrative warrant that this was kind of based on, too, that's in place. The biggest problem is that for an administrative warrant is not so much for routine inspections, but for fire cause problems, where we have a person that may have been involved in arson of the building, and then you leave the premises, and the Supreme Court of the United States has said once you leave that premise after a reasonable amount of time, then you can no longer go back on the property if the person will not allow you to go back on there. So if you make your routine inspection, or investigation of a fire, and you find some cause for arson, and it would be, a lot of this occurs at night, and should you leave and come back, then that person has the right to refuse you entry to that property.
Okay. I guess, if I may, Mr. Chair, I'm not sure. Have you folks been having real problems out there, you or your assistants? I guess your assistants includes anybody basically at the local level who
may be operating in terms of a supervisory capacity, fire suppression. Have you been encountering problems out there? Or?
We've had several incidents where it's been people that's involved with fire scene situations, suspicion of arson, where they have had to come back for whatever reason and get permission to get back on the property. And there's some confusion with the judges and the people issuing these administrative warrants. We haven't had a tremendous amount of situations like this. No.
Mr. Chairman, sir, you just, I'm reading the opinion here from the AG's office, and it says, fire inspections conducted immediately following a fire in order to learn the cause of the blaze are recognized by both Oregon and federal courts as exceptions to the general rule that either search warrants or consents are required for fire inspections. Mm-hmm. So you don't need a warrant in those circumstances?
Right, that's correct.
Okay, so it would be for the warrant, an inspection where there was no fire, the administrative inspection.
Well, if we went and asked the owner of a, let's say, a restaurant, in a routine inspection that we needed to inspect his property, and he said no, then we would have to get an administrative warrant to get on the property. Mm-hmm. We have already went through this process